The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
This week on Science for the People, we're tackling more controversial topics in the realm of healthcare. Hello, and welcome to Science for the People. Later on, we'll talk about the realities of race and healthcare with Dr. Keith Norris, Editor-in-Chief of the International Journal of Ethnicity and Disease. But first, I'm joined by Dr. Edward Archer, a research fellow with the Obesity Nutrition Research Center at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. He has a broad interdisciplinary background with graduate degrees and training in physiology, psychology, nutrition, exercise science, as well as epidemiology. Good to have you here, Ed.
Ah, well, thank you for having me.
Now, you've recently caused, a bit of consternation in nutrition science circles. You wrote an opinion piece for The Scientist titled, "A Wolf in Sheep's Clothing, Nutrition Research Must Overcome Pseudoscientific Measures and Self-Interest to Make Progress in the Fight Against Obesity." I assume you did not write that headline, but that definitely does capture the flavor of the piece. Can you give us an overview of that piece?
Back in November, I was a lead author on a study that demonstrated that roughly 70% of women and about 60% of the males who reported on their diet presented information or provided information that were physiologically implausible, which meant that the values that they gave us were incompatible with life. There was a recent editorial in the British Medical Journal using that term, saying that the values that are given in epidemiologic surveys are incompatible with life, which means when people report on their dietary intake, they're very rarely accurate. And yet, we base public policy on that. So in order to gain a handle on this, I was a bench scientist, which meant I work with hard science, I work with rodents, and I work with very detailed experiments. So when I moved into epidemiology, the first thing I wanted to do was to calibrate our instruments and look at how accurate are they. And what I found was that they're not accurate. They're fatally flawed. And I think this comes from, there's a number of things that we need to speak about today to kind of unpack the idea of all the problems that we're having in nutritional science. And that's the distinctions between research and science. Research is really just a mere collection of data, whereas science is the pursuit of lawful relationships. And then we have pseudoscience. And pseudoscience is something that's, it claims or data that are cloaked in the respectability of science, but they fail to meet the basic standards of rigor of the scientific method.
Now, as you said, we have a lot to unpack. So maybe let's start out with your research. We'll just give some people some background on what you're basing some of your position on. So you recently looked at the validity of the last four decades of the U.S. nutritional surveillance. So first off, who is surveilling nutrition and why?
In the United States, there are two major forms of nutritional surveillance. One of them is the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, and that's run by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, as well as the USDA. And then the second is our food supply. So that's the loss-adjusted food availability. So it's kind of an estimate of what people are actually eating, and that's performed by the USDA. The first paper that we're discussing was looking at the validity of the protocol used to determine the dietary intake of Americans. So the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, otherwise known as the NHANES. So the NHANES collects a representative sample of Americans, and they ask them what they eat. From a basic science standpoint, you don't really think that someone's going to be able to tell you accurately what they ate, and I wanted to confirm or disconfirm that thought. Because for the past 40 years, we've been basing our public health policy on what people are saying they're eating. So what my paper demonstrated, as I mentioned earlier, was that the vast majority of people are providing values that aren't even remotely accurate.
So then what exactly did your research look at? You looked at a number of issues, right?
Well, there's a long line of issues with the research. The first is the method that they use. The method that's used is called a 24-hour recall. So how a 24-hour recall works is we say, you know, it's an interview. They'll either meet with you face-to-face or they'll call you on the phone, and they'll say, what did you have for breakfast? And you'll tell them, you know, you'll go through the breakfast, and then you'll go through lunch, and then you'll go through dinner. And they'll do a multipass. They'll come back to breakfast and say, well, you said you had coffee. Did you have sugar with that coffee? Did you have something else? Did you have a bagel? Did you put butter on the bagel? And they'll go through this task over and over and over again, or this task over and over again, until they think that they've kind of exhausted you completely on what you've eaten for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And then they codify that, and they literally put it down in a diary, and then they pass that off to a researcher or a trained dietitian who will then code all of those foods. So if you said you had an apple, in the database there's an apple of a certain size, and they'll say, oh, it's 135 calories, and they'll put that down as 135 calories, and they'll do this for all of the foods that you've eaten across the entire day. And then what they'll do is they'll translate that into nutrient energy. So they'll say, you've eaten 2,412 calories. Now, the problems with this is that it fails to meet the rigor of science. I mean, the scientific method is very clear about what it needs to be. I mean, scientific measurement has to be observable, measurable, that is quantifiable, falsifiable, valid, and reliable. Now, when someone reports on what they're eating, that's not observable. Meaning we don't actually watch what they've eaten. What they're telling us is a perception. And they're only going to tell us a perception that they're comfortable telling us. So if a woman has eaten or a man has eaten, you know, 25 jelly donuts for breakfast, they're not likely to tell us that they've actually eaten 25 jelly donuts. So the report itself is not observable. It's not directly measurable. We're not actually measuring what they've eaten. And the person certainly hasn't measured out 8 ounces of orange juice and drank that. They're just saying that they've drank 8 ounces of orange juice. And it's not falsifiable, meaning we cannot look at that and say, well, you did or you didn't, because someone can say, I didn't eat anything yesterday. And that could be true, but we have no way of proving it, so we cannot confirm it or disconfirm it. So if we cannot refute the evidence, if we can't falsify it, that's problematic. That's the main problem with this. The second problem with this is that once we take that self-report, whatever someone said that they ate over the past 24 hours, we're then going to translate that into calories using a database. Now, those databases are by design inadequate and also, unfortunately, incomplete, because our food supply is changing daily. Yet the databases are sometimes decades old. And the values that we use for, say, a hamburger from McDonald's or Burger King, those values may be a decade old. Now, over the past 10 years, the formulation, the beef, the sauces, everything that they've used on their hamburgers may be very different. So the calories today in the database may be different than the calories were 10 years ago. So it's impossible for us to actually know what the person ate, number one, because they may not tell us, and number two, when we're translating it from what they told us into the nutrients and the calories, it may be coming from a database that's inadequate.
So what do other people in your field think about this study? Because I looked at the comment sections on some of the articles about this, and not everyone agrees with you.
No, not at all. The thing is, it's many times people, this is a little bit of a tangent, but people will always talk about funding. People will talk about how, you know, someone was either industry funded or government funded. And the vast majority of the people that are antagonistic to my study and antagonistic to my perception are part of the research oligarchy. They're part of the big government funding research oligarchy. And there's a large number of individuals who control research funding in this country, government research funding in this country. And those individuals view it as if I'm killing the cash cow, because the research that they're doing using this dietary self-report can be used for any outcome. You can say that any food is related to cancer or diabetes or obesity. And because of that, it generates more and more research over and over time because we don't have any definitive conclusions. Now, there's another group of researchers, individuals who think that, you know, the purpose of science is to improve the human condition, and I certainly fall into that category. I think that the purpose of science and research should be to serve the public, especially government-funded research. But there are many individuals whose careers have been built using this pseudoscience, and they're terrified that I'll take away their source of funding.
Typically, though, are people finding flaws with your research itself or with your interpretation of it then?
Well, the thing is, the data that was actually collected was collected by the federal government.
Right.
So this data is publicly available. Anyone can do the analyses that I've done. And the thing is, what's truly astounding to me is that no one had ever done this before. No one had actually ever gone into the data over 45 years and said, well, is this accurate? And if so, how accurate is it? So when I come along 45 years later and say, well, wait a second, this isn't very accurate and it's fatally flawed, you have people who have published literally hundreds of papers using this data suggesting that people are eating more calories. Well, my study clearly shows that we can't make that statement. There's no evidence to support that. Because when you actually factor in all the methods over time, calories are flat. So over the past 45 years, calories haven't gone up at all based on this method. So the biggest problem that we have is we have people making kind of these ludicrous statements about how many calories people are eating or how many calories people are now eating when they used to eat less, and there's no science behind it. So people who have a very long career using this pseudoscientific data are very upset with me. Whereas there's a good, you know, a sizable group of researchers who truly want to improve the human condition, who truly want to improve our future for ourselves and for our children. And in order to do that, we need science, and we need accurate and valid science.
Well, I don't think you'll find any disagreement there, but if I understand this correctly, even if people underestimate their caloric intake, the fact that these are long-term studies means that you can still track dietary changes over time, right?
Not necessarily. Not if the method has changed, because there's a number of problems. Number one, we're now telling people that they should move more and eat less. I mean, almost every news article about obesity will tell people that they should move more and eat less. Now, if the methodology is to be actually asking people how much they're eating, and we're telling them that they should be eating less, what we'll see is an effect in their self-reports. They'll tell us that they're eating less. They won't actually change their behavior. They won't actually eat less. They'll just tell us that they're eating less. And my research definitely showed that. There's a beautiful graph in my paper at PLOS One where you see a decrease in plausible reporting. So plausible reporting are people that actually provided a value that could be legitimate. They could actually survive on that amount of food. But what we're seeing over the past decade is a decrease. So as our public health policy message was, eat less, move more, people are now reporting eating less, but they're not necessarily eating less because we don't know. We only know what they're reporting.
So is this data useful for anything, in your opinion?
No. In a simple answer, no. I think the federal government is wasting hundreds of millions of dollars every year supporting research that will never give a definitive conclusion. And that's a very unpopular position because, I mean, even in my previous university, the University of South Carolina, there were individuals in the nutrition epidemiologic department, that actually tried to remove my press release from the website. They called the press department. They wanted my press release removed because they felt that it was going to threaten their federal funding. So I don't think that this data is valid. It's fatally flawed, meaning that if you have no idea of what someone actually ate, because a self-report is really just an edited version. People are going to tell us what they think we want to hear. If our public health message is you have to eat less, and if we have an obese individual who's been stigmatized their entire life, and they've been told that, oh, they should eat less and move more, they're going to tell us that they're eating less and moving more, even when they're not. And that's problematic. So if we're seeing this change in reporting behavior over time, then we can't use this data at any point in time. And more importantly, the nutrient databases, the databases where we translate what people tell us they eat into calories and nutrients, whether it's vitamins and minerals, those databases have changed over time. In 2003 and 2004, the USDA and the CDC decided to go in and actually start to measure some of these values, to empirically test how accurate the values were. And they made 400 changes out of about 500 foods. So the vast majority of the foods that they looked at weren't accurate. So most of the values in the databases come from industry standards. So the industry says, oh, it's 300 calories, and it's based on federal standards, which can be plus or minus 20%. So the databases themselves have changed over time, and the databases themselves are inadequate and sometimes invalid. So what does this data actually tell us? We have people telling us what they're eating. We're then translating it into foods with inadequate databases, and we're somehow supposed to base public policy on that? When someone tells us what they did yesterday, that's an anecdote. And the plural of anecdote is not data. I mean, when someone tells us what they ate, or we have 100 people telling us what they ate, those are stories. And I don't think that we should be basing our public health policy on stories, on anecdotes. We should be basing them on scientific data, which means it has to be observable, measurable, falsifiable, valid, and reliable. And dietary self-report has been demonstrated to be none of these, because not everyone underreports. Some people overreport. So in many ways, we can look at it as a measuring tape. If we have a measuring tape and we come and measure a board, and sometimes it's 2 inches too long and sometimes it's 2 inches too short and sometimes it's 10 feet too long and 10 feet too short, how could you ever cut that board and build a house? You couldn't. So the measurement tool is incredibly important if we're going to build the edifice of science. Our measurements have to be accurate. They have to be falsifiable. And when someone tells us they ate or they didn't eat or they had a dozen bananas yesterday or 300 bananas, there's no way we can falsify that. So therefore, it's outside the realm of science. And what we need to be doing is, instead of spending hundreds of millions of dollars on the pseudoscience, we need to be targeting those dollars towards finding more accurate measures of energy intake.
You're listening to Science for the People, and I'm talking to Dr. Edward Archer, a research fellow with the Obesity Nutrition Research Center at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, and we're talking about nutrition science. We'll be back with more of that after this.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. We're talking about nutrition science and pseudoscience with Dr. Edward Archer. Now, this is, I think this is the biggest point that I think you're making, and I do agree with that. We aren't talking about abstract pieces of research. People are making policy decisions based on nutritional survey data. So what kinds of policy are based on these surveys?
Well, think about some of the, our food pyramid, our sodium restrictions, our food-based guidelines on how many calories people should eat, how much cholesterol they should take in. So all of these policies, every food-based guideline is based on nutritional surveillance. So we have multiple sources of evidence for our nutritional policy. So there's this hard bench science, there are food chemists, and there's some really great nutrition scientists out there. The critique that I'm making about nutrition science in general is really for nutrition epidemiology and dietary self-report. So when we talk about how much sodium Americans are eating, that came from the Ed Haynes. And my work demonstrated very clearly that 70% of the values from females and 60% of the values from males weren't physiologically plausible, which meant that individuals could not survive on the amount of food that they told us they were eating. So when you misreport your energy, you're misreporting on all of the macronutrients. So if you're misreporting on total calories, by definition, you're misreporting on fat, protein, or carbs,
right,
or alcohol. So you're misreporting on one of those. And along with those is a correlation to the amount of sodium you're eating. So if you misreport on energy, your chances are you're misreporting on sodium, and we have no idea what the relationship between those two are because they're going to be different across people. So we have no idea how much sodium Americans are eating.
Okay, so all of that said, there's a difference between seeing an entire field as pseudoscience and seeing even a great number of the studies undertaken within that field as flawed. So which one of those is closer to your position?
Well, like I said, there is a huge number of truly great nutrition scientists out there working very hard. Dale Scholler at Wisconsin, David Allison here at the University of Alabama, individuals who are really trying to move the science of nutrition forward. But the problem is that the vast majority of nutrition epidemiologists are not paying attention. So my critique isn't for the field of nutrition per se. My critique is against the specific methodology that nutrition epidemiologists use, and that's the dietary self-report. It was demonstrated back in the early 1990s that across 37 studies across 10 countries, greater than two-thirds of the dietary self-reports were implausible, which meant the individuals could not survive on the calories that they were presenting. So it's not just a few studies here and there. It's an entire field. All dietary self-report is invalid, and it's been demonstrated for the past 20 years, and we've shown with doubly labeled water, which is a non-radioactive isotope, it's a measure of total daily energy expenditure. And very clearly, every time you measure dietary self-report compared to total daily energy expenditure, there's misreporting. And the misreporting varies based on gender, weight status, previous weight status, education levels, race. You have this huge list of variables, and it would be impossible to control for all those variables in order to improve this data. And we shouldn't be trying to change the data. What we should be doing is changing our method to collect the data.
Okay, so what are you suggesting in terms of collecting the data then? Like, what would a good nutritional study look like to you?
Well, I think that goes to a bigger point when it comes to nutrition. One of the biggest problems that we have in nutrition is there's a term called nutrient partitioning. And nutrient partitioning is a fancy way of saying what our body does with the food we eat. So when you eat a food, your body has to metabolize that, and it's going to partition it or send it to different areas. It's either going to store it as fat, it's going to oxidize it. And the number one, the only modifiable determinant of that is physical activity. So when we're measuring dietary intake, we also have to measure the body into which it's going. Because a person's body composition, their sex, their hormonal status, and the major modifiable determinant is their physical activity, we need to accurately measure all of those components before we'll know what that food does in that person's body. Because an individual who goes out and runs marathons is going to partition their food very, very differently than the individual that sat on the sofa watching the marathon. So for the perfect dietary study, what we have to be doing is actually looking at the physiology of the individual, looking at the physiology of the nutrient partitioning. So doubly labeled water is a wonderful, it's expensive, but it's a wonderful measure for total daily energy expenditure. So that's a good start, meaning how much energy are you expending? And then we can measure their body composition with DEXA, it's called dual energy X-ray absorptometry, and what that does is it actually measures your bone mass, your fat mass, and your muscle mass. And with that, we can determine changes in energy stores and your total daily energy expenditure, and then we'll know exactly how many calories you ingested. So we don't need to measure the food, we need to measure the product of that food.
Okay, so just to throw another problem in the mix here, and you didn't really mention it in your piece, but I assume that the research flaws that you're mentioning would only be exacerbated by the media. So what do you see happening there?
There's been a couple of great examples of misuse of nutrition research in the media. I mean, recently there was a paper that came out, and it was probably one of the most egregious examples of just pseudoscience that I've seen, saying that if you ate protein before you were 65 years of age, it was harmful, but if you ate protein after you were 65 years of age,
right,
it was healthy. Well, protein is the second most abundant substance in our body after water. Your body needs protein. There's no question on this. And the amount of protein we need is based on our body composition, based on our activity levels, based on the turnover of our protein. So what this study did was it mixed a whole bunch of different types. It mixed animal models with humans, and then it used the data from the NHANES. And what they did was they did a number of things. It's called double dipping. They used the same statistics, the same group of same population to determine a cutoff, and then they went back in and used the statistics to analyze that data from that cutoff. And you can't do that statistically. Yet this was published in Cell Metabolism. And the problem with this is these researchers came out and they knew what grab headlines. They did research specifically to grab a headline as opposed to improve the human condition. Research should serve the general public, especially government-funded research. So what happens is researchers, they want to be famous, just like everybody else in the world. So they put forth something that they know, there's pretty clear evidence that it's pseudoscience. Yet they'll put it forward because it'll get a headline, they'll get their name in the newspaper, and they'll get more grant funding. Or they'll get notoriety for their university. And this is problematic. The media, you can't expect journalists to have PhDs in nutrition or in physiology. So it's very easy for a researcher to manipulate a journalist by writing a specific headline, writing a headline that's going to grab attention. Now, I'm guilty of writing headlines that grab attention, but what I'm trying to draw attention to is pseudoscience in nutrition research. What I'm trying to draw attention to is to improve science, improve the research protocols, so we can actually determine something. So I think the greatest problem is researchers misrepresenting their work to the media, and then the media just running with that, because the media wants to sell headlines and wants to sell newspapers.
Well, and you mentioned the funding issue again. And of course, we should point out that when you're talking about, in your piece, about the desire for funding being one of the reasons why we see flawed research, the funding for your study was provided by an unrestricted research grant from the Coca-Cola company. So,
sure,
thoughts?
Without a doubt. I'm completely 100% transparent. I mean, I'm currently now funded by the federal government. Previously, I was funded by multiple, both industry and the federal government. And my opinion doesn't change depending on my funding. I think there's a little bit of an ad hominem attack when people say, oh, well, this person was funded by big oil or big pharma or big food. They forget that there's also big government research. And so in the UK and also in Canada, there's many problems with the government kind of injecting themselves into the research process and controlling science and controlling access to scientists and access to information. So government isn't innocuous at all. But for my research, this particular research was investigator-initiated, which means I went to the federal government and said, will you fund this? I submitted a grant, and they said no, because they would never want me to critique their own work. The federal government doesn't want to be critiqued, which is understandable. So I went to industry and said, this is an idea I think that's really important. Who will fund it? And I was able, myself and my mentor, Dr. Stephen Blair at the University of South Carolina, we were able to find an organization. And Coca-Cola donates to an educational research fund. And from that educational research fund, I was funded to look at the validity of data. So the biggest problem with industry funding is when the individual itself is collecting their own data. If an industry-funded individual is collecting data, there can be some problems there, because we call them researcher degrees of freedom. There are lots of ways that researchers can manipulate data, but the data that I was analyzing is publicly available. Anyone can do the analyses that I've done. So in this particular study, I hope that people will go out and redo my analyses, because they'll find the exact same thing that I found. Because it's pretty obvious, it's very simple, there's multiple ways, it's not rocket science. I mean, a first-year statistics student with a little bit of math background could do what I did. And I use multiple methods. So you can look at either of the methods and do the comparison, and they'll come up with the same results. It's when people come up with different results that this is problematic. So Funding shouldn't be an issue, because the temptation to sin and actually sinning are two different things. So we may all be tempted, but would we actually do it? And I find it a little insulting when someone says, oh, well, you know, you were funded by Big Food, and therefore all your opinions are tainted. And that's challenging the scientist as opposed to challenging the science. Please challenge my science. Show me I did something wrong. Improve my measure. Because that's what I'm telling others to do. I'm telling others to improve their measure. So please, don't attack me. Attack my method. Attack my research. And if you can attack my research and knock it down, and I can build it back up again and make it better, you've improved me. Whereas if you just attack me, what you're doing is you're creating a chilling effect on the social scientific dialogue. So I think we need to stop attacking individuals. There was an individual who was industry funded in the UK, who was sitting on a board that was determining the policies for sugar. And everyone said, oh, well, he's industry funded. Well, he's also a great researcher. And his integrity is well above question, as is mine. I mean, you cannot buy my opinion. And I kind of laugh, because the amount of money that we get for research funding is incredibly small. And not that long ago, I was playing polo in Palm Beach. So if someone thinks a few research dollars is going to buy my opinion, they don't know me. So I think that, you know, the funding problem isn't as much of a problem as people think it is. And I think that as long as the data is accessible and it's transparent and anyone can look at it, then let's challenge the data, let's challenge the method, and let's stop attacking the scientists.
So if this is indeed a problem, and even you've proposed a number of changes on a number of levels, but even after all that, it would still be very difficult to tell us what we really all want to know, honestly, which is namely, what should I be eating? Because that's an incredibly complex question, is it not?
Well, every question can be as simple or as complex as we make it. I mean, I think when Einstein came up, you know, developed his equation of E equals MC squared, what he did was he simplified the universe. And before him, Sir Isaac Newton simplified the universe by coming up with F equals MA. Now, both are correct within their perspective, and I think that we can simplify things by looking at the data. In 2012, it might be 2013, the Centers for Disease Control put out their biomarker analysis of the U.S. population. So they took a random sample of the United States population, and they measured biomarkers. They measured vitamin A, vitamin C, vitamin D, vitamin E. They measured iron status. And what they found was 80% of Americans were not at risk for any deficiency. Now, risk of deficiency is before risk of disease. So you have individuals who actually have a disease, they have the risk for disease, and then they have a risk for deficiency for that disease. So 80% of Americans are eating a nutritionally complete diet because they're not at risk for any of the biomarkers that were tested. And more importantly, 90% of women of childbearing age, from their teens up to their late 30s, were not at risk for iron deficiency. So contrary to popular opinion that our diets are so terrible, if our diets are so terrible or vitamin deficient, why is most of our population, the vast majority of our population, so healthy when it comes to biomarkers? What we're not healthy in is our obesity status, our diabetes status, and those are energy-dependent chronic non-communicable diseases. And those are driven more by our activity levels and our sitting on the sofa and watching TV. I mean, the number one correlate of childhood obesity is having an obese mother. The second one is having a TV in your bedroom. So every time a mother uses a TV as a babysitter, every calorie that isn't going to build bone and muscle is going to build fat mass. And that's part of the problem. So what I would say is our diets, our food supply is probably the greatest that has, you know, in human history by far. Our food supply is probably better now than it has ever been in human history. I mean, hunter-gatherers usually eat somewhere between 50 to 100 different types of foods. Walk into a supermarket. There are thousands of different types of foods. So our variety and the quality is so much better. And yes, people eat fast food. But they're not that deficient, because if they were that deficient, then the CDC's biochemical analysis wouldn't have improved from 1999 to 2008. which was then published in 2012 or 2013. I think it was 2013. So if our biochemical analysis of our blood, I mean, we're taking serum biomarkers, this is a hard outcome, and we're saying, hey, 80% of us are not at risk for anything, how bad can our diet be?
Then where are we with dietary recommendations then? Do we have an idea of what people should or should not be eating?
Yes, I think we do. I think we have some very good ones. I think there are individuals who have sodium-sensitive high blood pressure. Now, individuals who have sodium-sensitive high blood pressure should be consuming a very small amount of sodium. If you do not have sodium-sensitive high blood pressure, you can eat a fair amount of sodium without any health consequences. But the problem is, to make a blanket statement that all Americans should be eating less salt is unproductive, because individuals of Northern European descent handle salt loads pretty well. I'm a white male, I'm from Northern Europe. I can drink a lot of water with a lot of salt, and my body will pass that water and pass that salt very simply. My kidneys function really well to remove that sodium. But certain individuals, I mean individuals of African descent, tend not to handle salt loads. They evolved and they grew up in environments that had very little salt, and it was a hot environment, so their body holds on to salt loads. So many African Americans have high blood pressure, and there's a couple of reasons for this. I mean, there's some argument back and forth in the literature whether or not their kidneys are actually smaller, their aldosterone levels, their angiotensin system is a little bit different. But the one thing we do know is that they don't react well to sodium. So African Americans who have high blood pressure really need to cut back on their sodium. So we have guidelines that work really well, but they're going to be patient-specific. So it's almost like individualized policy. So if your parents were obese, chances are you need to be more careful about the number of calories that you're taking in and the exercise you're getting. Because I think Hippocrates, kind of the father of modern medicine, in his Regimen in Health said, eating alone will not keep a man well. He must take exercise. And that he was saying that to a population where they didn't have cars, they didn't have elevators, they didn't have escalators, and they certainly didn't have television. So imagine how much more exercise we need to put into our lives. So I think, eat less, move more. I think we're eating pretty well, but I think we need to move a great deal more. I mean, the flip side of my research is looking at physical activity. And I had a paper come out not that long ago that stay-at-home moms are burning about 300 calories less per day than they did in the 1960s. And no one's going to turn around and say that we're actually eating 300 calories less, because we don't have the evidence. There's no evidence whether we're eating more or eating less. But we definitely know that individuals are less active. There was a great paper on occupational energy expenditure by Dr. Jim Church at Pennington, came out a few years ago in 2011, showing that across the board, men are expending about 140 calories less on a population level. So sitting at a desk, as opposed to chopping down trees in the wood, there's a huge decrease in physical activity. So I think we need to listen to Hippocrates and increase our physical activity. Go for a 10-minute walk after breakfast, a 10-minute walk after lunch, and a 20-minute walk after dinner, and you meet the federal guidelines. And you will have a dramatic impact on your health, and it will also bend that curve down so you're not gaining weight as quickly.
That sounds a whole lot easier than trying to figure out which vegetables and or protein sources and or fruit are good for us this week.
Well, I think fruit, obviously, you want to eat a variety of foods. So you don't want to be just eating a specific fast food. You don't want to be eating massive amounts. Even if it's kale and carrots, you don't want to eat just kale and carrots. You want to eat a wide variety of foods, and we have an amazing variety of foods. So eating fruits and vegetables, lean protein sources, these are wonderful. So I don't think we need to spend as much time worrying and fretting about our diet, because I think the state of our nutrition is much better than we think it is. And I think that the media is tended to scare us into thinking that we're really all unhealthy when we're not. Because if you look at the data from a vitamin and mineral standpoint, we're not that unhealthy. Now, we are, calcium is an issue, so we need to perhaps increase our dairy products, our non-fat dairy products. But I mean, overall, I think the biggest deficiency that we have on a national level, both probably true in the U.S. and in Canada, is activity. I mean, I had a paper coming out showing that obese women were performing less than 1 hour a year of vigorous activity. Now, that was a very very specific definition of vigorous activity, but 1 hour a year, that was their average. And we used physical activity monitors. They were accelerometry-based physical activity monitors. So we were literally monitoring how much they're moving, how much literal spatial displacement they have, and it's kind of an indirect measure of how much time they're spending sitting. So as a nation, we're incredibly sedentary. We tend not to move, and that's causing our health problems. Especially when a woman is pregnant and she's inactive, she's providing more nutrition and more energy to her fetus, and that fetus is going to grow larger. So across the globe, this has been happening. As we have labor and time-saving devices have diffused throughout the world, we have more and more children being born from C-sections. And the reason for this is dystocia, meaning the labor cannot progress. And the reason the labor cannot progress is because the child's grown so large. Their head circumference has grown dramatically. And it's the head that's the most difficult part to get through. So all of these things, you know, are centering on nutrition, but in reality, the biggest problem is what our body is doing with that nutrition, which goes back to nutrient partitioning. So how we spend our day determines our health, much more so at this point in our history than our nutrition. 100 years ago, I would have said the exact opposite. 100 years ago, it was all nutrition, and because we were all physically active. Now, we're all physically inactive, and we have amazing food supply. So I think we need to turn it on its head and say, let's get more active. Especially moms, especially low SES moms who don't have a partner to help them. I mean, to raise a child is incredibly taxing as far as time and effort and resources. And when they don't have a partner, by the end of the day, they're exhausted, so they sit in front of the TV, and they use the TV as a babysitter for their children. This is what's leading to the obesity epidemic, especially driving the low SES, our low socioeconomic status, our poor. We have huge rates of obesity in our poor, and those are the individuals who tend to be the least active. Probably one of the most important points, if your listeners had one take-home point from this entire interview, it's how we spend our day determines our health. And how we spend our time eating is a very small portion of our health at this point in time in our history, because we have such an amazing food supply. But most of us, we drive our kids to school, they sit at a desk all day long, then they come home and they sit in front of the TV or they sit playing video games and they go to sleep. So they have the sit-sit-sleep profile. They're living their lives from one chair to the next. And what this is doing is driving the obesity problem as well as the energy-contingent non-communicable diseases such as cancer and cardiovascular disease and diabetes. So how we spend our day is incredibly important. So what we need to do is we need to educate ourselves and our children on being more physically active and then enforcing that to change our world so physical activity is simple and easier. We put parking spaces for pregnant women right in front of the store. Well, that's not what they should be. They should be walking and they should be exercising. They should be expending energy so that their child can be born healthy. Because I think in our modern society, I mean, women have so many more choices now than they ever have. And I think the most important thing is to choose to bring a healthy child into this world. And to do so, you need to be physically active. Yes, you need to eat fruits and vegetables and take whatever mineral and vitamin supplements your obstetrician tells you. But I think most importantly, it's activity.
So apparently the one thing that hasn't changed in terms of dietary advice then is that there are no shortcuts.
Without a doubt. I mean, and that kind of goes back to the idea between prevention and treatment. I think prevention of obesity is physical activity. Treatment is a whole other ballpark. There are definitely no shortcuts to treatment of activity, but we do know from the National Weight Loss Registry. The National Weight Loss Registry is a collection of individuals who've had physician-documented losses of body weight over a long period of time, and they've maintained that. Because we know that, you know, it's well established in the scientific community that 95 to 99% of the individuals who lose weight will regain that weight over the next few years. But the individuals that have maintained that weight loss, almost without exception, have added voluminous amounts of physical activity to their life. They usually start off with walking after each meal, and then they started running as much as possible and lifting weights. And the complement of running and lifting weights or walking and lifting weights is wonderful for your health. There was an old custom of a constitutional where people would take a walk after their evening meals. This was a wonderful, wonderful habit to get into. So just a little bit of activity each day is what we really need. So there are no shortcuts. We have to change our behavior. But the behaviors we have to change is not going from eating spinach to eating kale or from eating, you know, white potatoes to sweet potatoes. The change is turn off the television and get some exercise. And it has to be deliberate exercise. You have to get up and say, I'm going to do this for my health. I'm going to park further away. I'll take the stairs, not the elevator, and just find simple ways. And especially if you're a pregnant female, I mean, actually, if you're planning on becoming pregnant, you know, get your preconception weight down. Be healthy as possible. Increase your strength to weight ratio. Because what happens across your pregnancy is you're going to gain weight. And when you gain weight, you become less physically active because it costs more energy. It takes more effort to move. Whereas if you gain strength in your legs through weightlifting and you've been running, well, now all of a sudden when you decrease your physical activity a little bit, it's not as much of a problem for your fetus. But if all of a sudden you're sedentary before you're pregnant and then you get pregnant, and inactive women have a much harder time getting pregnant than active women, so getting off the sofa is probably much more important than making a dietary choice by far, because that getting off the sofa determines what your body will do with that dietary choice. How you spend your day determines what your body does with the food you eat. And that's the number one thing that people have to pay attention to, because when someone says, oh, sugar is toxic, well, to whom? I mean, someone who's running triathlons all day long consumes huge amounts of sugar. I consume huge amounts of sugar because I'm expending it. It's what body is that food going into? I mean, people who say, oh, white potatoes are terrible. Well, white potatoes kept the Irish alive for a really long time. And when that crop failed, they came to the U.S. So we had this mass migration when white potatoes failed as a crop due to the potato blight. So when people demonize food, I mean, we demonized saturated fat in the 50s, and now we're demonizing sugar, and then it's going to be demonizing something else. It's not the food. It's what our bodies are doing with the food. And right now, that's pathological because we're inactive.
Okay, so I am not pregnant, nor do I plan to be, but you have made me feel so guilty, I am going for a walk. Ed, thank you very much for being here.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
We've linked to Dr. Edward Archer on our site at scienceforthepeople.ca. And we'll be right back with Dr. Keith Norris, Editor-in-Chief of the International Journal of Ethnicity and Disease, to talk about the intersection of race and medicine.
On the next episode of Science for the People, we're learning about some of the many invisible particles that surround us. We'll speak to astrophysicist Ray Jayawardena about his book Neutrino Hunters, the thrilling chase for a ghostly particle to unlock the secrets of the universe. And we'll talk to ecology professor Donald Canfield about his book Oxygen, a 4-billion-year history. That's next week on Science for the People, on your local radio station, or online at scienceforthepeople.ca.
Welcome back to Science for the People. This is Desiree Schell, and my guest today is Dr. Keith C. Norris. He's an internationally recognized clinician scientist and health policy leader who's been instrumental in shaping national health policy and clinical practice guidelines. He was the principal investigator for the multi-site NIH-funded African-American study of kidney disease and hypertension, and the cohort study, the largest comparative drug intervention trial focusing on renal outcomes conducted in African-Americans. He's also the editor-in-chief of the international journal Ethnicity and Disease, a multidisciplinary journal focusing on minority ethnic population differences in health promotion and disease prevention, including research in the areas of epidemiology, genetics, health services, social biology, and medical anthropology. Welcome to the show, Keith.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, now to make this not easy at all for you at all to start out, let's start with some definitions. What is race exactly? I know that's a big question.
It really is. So really for me, I see there's a sort of technically one race, the human race. But what we see in science and just in the world that people get broken up into different groups, usually white, Anglo, predominantly Northern European, African-American, Asian, and then people will also use ethnicity rather than race. And usually, and especially for the federal government in the United States, then they divide ethnicity into Hispanic or Latino or non-Hispanic or Latino. And from my perspective, it's used as a social construct, and it really is a social construct, but it's sort of morphed or merged its way into biology. And it becomes kind of confusing because we see it in biology and science all the time as race. And there's a sense that it's a biological construct, but it's really not.
So it is both of those then. There are biological differences due to race.
So in that social construct, there are certain biological traits that tend to be more commonly prevalent in one group than another. And that's primarily because of evolution and geography. So we will see, for instance, in African Americans or individuals who are from African descent, they'll have much higher rates of sickle cell trait or sickle cell disease because in Africa, where malaria is highly prevalent, having sickle cell disease and sickle cell trait is not totally protective, but it helps to protect against malaria. Other areas in the world that have malaria will also have higher rates of sickle cell trait or disease. When individuals leave that area and they're in a part of the world where there is no malaria, but they have sickle cell disease, now there are medical complications related to having sickle cell disease or even sickle cell trait that occur, particularly as people get older, and that trait which was advantageous when they were at risk for getting malaria now becomes disadvantageous when there is no malaria around.
Right. Well, and there are, this is not just in the African American population. There are many diseases that, or many ethnicities that are more at risk of certain diseases, right?
Absolutely. So in certain Jewish communities, there are much higher rates of risk for breast cancer. And so we see a variety of different medical conditions being more prevalent in one group or another group, which predominantly tends to be linked to geography and where that group arose geographically over space and time. And then later on, we just now see it associated with a particular group for one reason or another.
Well, and so it's not just risk factors. It's there also might be different treatment responses required depending on race.
Absolutely. So we'll see for reasons, again, that are not totally clear, treatment with different medications may vary depending on how a drug is metabolized. And we see different rates of metabolism in different groups. And again, when I say different groups, it's sort of generic. So does it hold to everybody within that group, but just that it is a priori, it would be more likely to find a person in a particular group may be a higher metabolizer or lower for a particular drug. And we see that not only in drugs, we'll see it with even certain, I don't know, I wouldn't classify as a medication per se, although it has been thought to have medicinal purposes, but things such as alcohol. Mm. There are certain enzymes that break down alcohol. There's alcohol dehydrogenase, and we see that that enzyme is much lower in Asians in general per se. And so that can lead to differences in the effects of alcohol, and those enzymes may also be important and relevant as it relates to metabolizing certain medications as well.
Now, how is research like this done? Because all I can think is that it must be difficult to control for race in research.
So controlling for race in research is really difficult. And how most of it is done is self-identification, which again reinforces the fact that it's a social construct. Somebody identifies themselves as belonging to a particular group. So it doesn't mean there are not studies where there are more intensive analyses where one will look at, let's just say, DNA to try to determine one's ethnic origins per se. But really, all that DNA would say is what percentage of your genes come from a particular continent or a particular area of a continent. So when I think about the biology of race per se, it really is not the biology of race. It really becomes the biology of specific genes or enzymes or markers in someone's system that says they are more likely to respond to a particular treatment, not respond to a treatment, respond to a certain medication in a particular way that they would need more or less of that medication. And so the goal is to try to move to that level of precision rather than saying, because somebody has identified themselves as being of a particular race ethnicity, that now my guess is a little better than my guess would have been without that information.
Right. Well, maybe let's talk about a bit of a case study. You've done research into race and kidney disease. So how did you do that research?
Most of the research that I've done with race and kidney disease has been based on self-identification. In a lot of the data sets that we use, people identify themselves as Hispanic or Latino, white, black, Asian, Native American, and then we use that information to look at and link that as we look at the likelihood of people belonging to a particular group who have kidney disease, what is their mortality rates, what complications occur in that group, and are people in one group more likely to have certain complications than people in another group. But we commonly see is that what tends to drive a large portion of the outcomes that we look at tends to be socioeconomic factors, education, where people live, the environment where they live, the whether or not people have insurance or not. And so those factors tend to be the factors that mediate predominantly why a person from who identifies themselves as belonging to a particular group is more likely or less likely to have a good or poor health outcome.
So then we don't exactly know if those differences are gene-based, let's say, or some kind of biologic-based, or if there are differences due to some kind of cultural environmental factor.
We definitely know there are a lot of differences due to culture and environmental. I think the goal of science is to now try to find out, in addition to that, are there some gene or biological differences that may also be playing a role, and can we understand and learn from that information, because that information can help not only play a role in improving the health of a group that's at risk, but that information should be helpful for everybody. So the one good thing about differences, so if there's no differences, then it's hard to figure out if there's anything going on. But the fact that there are differences between people, that in and of itself creates the opportunity to try to figure out what different factors are playing a role, how we can understand them, and how we can use them.
You're listening to Science for the People, and I'm here with Dr. Keith C. Norris, the editor-in-chief of the International Journal Ethnicity and Disease. Okay, so looking at everything that you've said then, how useful is the concept of race when we're talking about personalized medicine?
In my mind, as we're moving to personalized medicine, that actually becomes one of the elements that should transcend race. Because now, as we get personalized medicine, we're really not looking at how somebody identifies themselves, but we're looking at for a particular medical condition, if somebody has high blood pressure, if somebody has diabetes, that we're getting to the point that by drawing some blood tests, the blood tests will tell us what are the best medications for that person, regardless of what their race ethnicity is. Because now we've gotten down to the point that within their body, these tests for personalized medicine should be able to give us those fine elements of detail. The more traditional questions around race ethnicity and elements of race ethnicity as a healthcare provider, as a physician, really help one prioritize and think about, in talking to a particular patient, what are some other factors that need to be considered that may be important related to insurance status, medication, do they have the ability to afford medication, healthy lifestyles, recommendations that we're going to make. Now, we should be asking these same questions for everybody, but we may change the priority of how we ask these questions based on someone's background and where they come from. Because in general, we know that one would say that there's more likely to be A, B, or C for group one versus group two.
So then basically we're using the concept of race because we don't have anything better yet.
That's probably the clearest and most succinct way to place it.
Okay. Well, just how sensitive a topic is this? I mean, anything that discusses race or gender or class tends to end up being contentious. So is right. That reflected in the research on race and medicine?
It is. It's and it varies tremendously. Clearly, there are a lot of concerns when people think about the conversation around race, ethnicity, and even around personalized medicine, where the field is moving toward having a better understanding of genes and biomarkers, because there's a risk that this information will be used by insurance companies or employers to discriminate against individuals. And so that's always a big concern. At the same time, there's a sense that race, ethnicity may be that in and of itself, as you mentioned, becomes very contentious for some people. And so how people interpret race, ethnicity, and how, and the judgments they make can be more or less, I would say, contentious, because a lot of people will take judgments based on what they've heard, their life experiences, and those particular judgments that they then associate with an individual may have nothing to do with that individual, but they're making that judgment associated with that individual just because of their physical appearance. And this holds not only for race, ethnicity, it holds for gender as well. And so we see this frequently, and it can cause a lot of problems.
Well, I guess my other concern is that it can sometimes seem that acknowledging any biological differences opens the door to the idea that there are a host of other biological differences, ones that there aren't evidence for. Have you run into that?
Yeah, so that it clearly does open that door. The good news is, from the Human Genome Project, 99.99 and some other nines of the genes are the same between everybody. And actually, the major biological differences are between gender, not between race, ethnicity. Similarly, when we look at drugs and the metabolism of drugs, response to treatment, it's probably much more dramatic by age. So if we look at children versus elderly, we're going to see much more dramatic differences by and large than we would see across quote-unquote race, ethnicity. So while there may be these other some specific differences, and there may be certain genes that tend to be more common in one group than another, just as we see skin color genes for melanin are more common in certain groups than other groups. And again, there may be certain genes that tend to follow, that may be closely linked to maybe the gene for melanin per se. But by and large, the differences between racial and ethnic groups from a genetic and a biologic perspective are much less than the differences between gender and even between generations.
Well, that's interesting, because we really only recently started building the idea of diversity into our research. It was spectacularly undiverse for the longest time, was it not?
Correct. And that's because in any country where there is a predominant group from a power structure and by vast numbers, there tends to be a lack of acknowledgement almost of the existence of those that don't belong to the major group. And so it's as we see more diversity, we see much more admixture, not only in the United States, but I think globally, as we're seeing this globally. And there's a greater recognition that for the health of the entire country, for any country, it's important that there's great health for everybody. And even for the economy of the country, there should be better economics for everybody. So I think there's now a greater sensitivity and a greater awareness of the concept that the whole needs to be, that every part needs to be doing well for the whole to do well. Take our body. We don't think about our feet as often probably as we think about our hands and our face. But if our feet are not doing well and we don't care about our feet, it will eventually have an adverse impact on the rest of our body. So when we start thinking about our feet and taking care of our feet, and at least having an appreciation and awareness of our feet as we do the rest of us, then that makes us whole as an individual. The same holds for society.
Oh, I'm going to leave it there. That was a lovely metaphor. Thanks for being here, Keith.
My pleasure.
That was Dr. Keith Norris, the editor-in-chief of the International Journal of Ethnicity and Disease, and we've linked to him on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. While you're there, click the links to connect with us on Google+, Facebook, Twitter, and, of course, subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Science for the People. Science for the People is recorded in Edmonton, Alberta. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our promotions manager. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler.
K.O. Myers updates our website. Helen Quivillon is our publishing liaison. Ed Haynes is our guest coordinator. We get research help from Josh Witten. The show is edited by K.O. Myers and Ryan Bromsgrove. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Rochelle Saunders, Marie-Claire Shanahan, and me, Desiree Schell.